Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to today's panel discussion. As usual, I need to ask you to kindly switch off your mobile devices. And also, when you have a chance, take a look at our great lineup of events in the coming weeks. Just after the Chinese New Year break, we have Larry Lipscher, writer of four books about taxation. He'll come here and deliver a talk entitled Bungee Jumping, the Fiscal Cliff. That's on February 26. Here's a quick background to today's discussion. The government proposes to block public access to directors' addresses and their ID card numbers in company records. As you may be aware, the FCC collected just under 200 signatures from our members last month in a petition urging the government to retract the proposal. We're also talking to the government, which has resumed its public consultation on the matter before a vote in LegCo in May. This is, of course, also a very valuable opportunity to have a broader public debate on transparency versus privacy. Without further ado, let me introduce our three distinguished guests today. From the left in the middle, we have David Webb of website.com, former independent director of Hong Kong Exchanges and Clearing. And next to him, we have Steve Vickers, CEO of Steve Vickers and Associates, former head of the Royal Hong Kong Police Criminal Intelligence Bureau. Last but not least, next to Steve, we have William McGovern, partner in Cobra & Kim, a litigation firm, and also former branch chief of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission's Enforcement Division. So each guest will first speak for a few minutes, and we'll have plenty of time afterwards for Q&A. So we'll first invite Mr. Webb to speak first, followed by the other two gentlemen. Thank you.
Good afternoon. It's good to be back at the FCC. To see the directors of the FCC, a company limited by guarantee, sitting on the table on my left. P135143(9). That's my ID number. I am David Webb, but there are several David Webbs in Hong Kong. And I published my ID number in an article about this subject 2 years ago, when the government first consulted on amending the company's ordinance. Unfortunately, this seemed to have escaped most of the media's attention at the time, so we now find ourselves with that law having actually been passed, but in order to put it into effect, there is subsidiary legislation now up for debate, and of course, if that doesn't get passed, the law goes into limbo, and I expect it will be eventually repealed. Now, it's important to be able to identify people, and an ID number is nothing more than that. It's an identifier. It's a more accurate version of your name. You might have quite an unusual name. You might be the only one in Hong Kong or even the world, but many of us share names with other people. I myself am an example of this. 6 years ago, I'd be another prop out here, a Chinese newspaper published this article, and it's about me, and it says that I've been very successful in the property market. Apparently, I bought a house in Mount Kellett Road, and sold it and made a $12 million profit. Of course, if I'd had more sense, I would have hung on to it. Doubled the money by now. It wasn't me. Whoever wrote that story didn't bother to call me for comment. Probably a quick paragraph pulled out of the land registry. My name was there, but it wasn't me. If my ID number had been there, and if it had been publicly available in an index that the government had published with all the names and ID numbers, if it had been used in other contexts, such as my appointments to various bodies, Takeover Panel or the HKX board, then they could have checked against those and said, yes, that must be the same person. So there's an example from firsthand of why it's important to have these identifiers in the public domain and not to obscure them. In 2010, it wasn't just me saying this. The Law Society made a submission also against the law change and in favor of maintaining transparency on ID numbers. Banks and utility companies should not be using ID numbers on the phone to say, can you just prove who you are? They shouldn't be asking you for your date of birth either, because if you've ever published your birthday photos on Facebook or somewhere else, then people can work out your date of birth pretty easily. Or your parents may have published it when you were born in a nice announcement which is now in scanned newspapers online. So, you know, they need to establish their own authentication protocols with telecoms companies and their customers and so on, and not be so lazy as to use publicly available information. And I've suggested that through their regulators, the Communications Authority for Banks and for Phone Companies and Pay TV, the Monetary Authority for Banks, they should give them all 2 years' notice that they're going to start publishing the list of ID numbers and names, and that they should find other ways to authenticate their customers. The other proposal is to not require people to file a normal residential address in their company filings, and instead allow them to file a correspondence address with the residential address held in reserve and accessible through court orders and other procedures. Now, as somebody who criticizes a lot of people on my website and has been a company director, I am not entirely comfortable with the people I'm criticizing being able to find out where my family sleeps at night. And directors of the SEC, who are also journalists, you might find one day the same level of discomfort if you've been investigating an important person in the mainland or in Hong Kong, and your address is available through the company filings of the FCC at the registry. So I think that there's a strong argument for saying, as long as a designated address is available, and you can be sued at that address, and that's important, that legal paperwork will count. You've put that address out there as your contact point. If you then ignore legal writs or other notices and get a judgment against you in default, you can't complain because that was the address you gave. I'm comfortable with having correspondence addresses and not being able to hunt people down at their homes and put them at personal security risk. So those are the issues on the company's ordinance, but there's a bigger issue here, which is transparency in general. The government still has a secrecy approach to public filings. It has a pay-per-view approach at the land registry and a pay-per-view approach at the company's registry. It costs a lot of money to drill down through the directors of a company and find their other directorships. You're paying every time you click, basically. And yet, if you look at the public accounts of this statutory monopoly, you'll find that the company's registry makes a huge profit, and it would do so even if it charged nothing for search fees. It makes more than enough from filing fees, which should be lower, to make a very substantial profit already. So I would say to Ada Chung, the Registrar of Companies, in the words of Ronald Reagan, tear down this wall. Tear down the paywall, make the registry open to public access, and likewise for the land registry. If you need an example, look at New Zealand. Their company's registry is fully open. And the transparency that goes with that would assist people doing due diligence in private banks, looking out for money laundering, investigations of mainland officials' family assets, and all sorts of other purposes. Even the SME Association in Hong Kong is against this law, again, for the reasons of being able to know more about their counterparties, and so is the Association of Banks. So the government needs to take that broader point on board and tear down the paywalls. Thanks.
Thank you. Next we have Steve Baker.
Good afternoon. Well, I hate to say it, but I completely agree with David, which is terrifying. I've been in the business, both in the government and the private sector, looking at people chasing assets, looking for money laundering and the rest for 30 plus years. This is a dumb law. These regulations will make it easier for money launderers, will make it easier for people to do malfeasance, and it makes it more difficult for ordinary Hong Kong business people, forgetting the money launderers and the organized criminals, but people who want to make a decision about, I want to sell my plastic pens to a factory I don't know in Sampo Kong, but I can't see enough particulars about the people to make a basic credit decision. It makes no sense from a monetary point of view at the low end, and certainly it does help people obfuscate what's going on. It's a problem. We have Macau just over the road producing $39 billion in gaming revenues, perhaps times five if you really work out the side betting. That money moves through junket operators, many of whom are listed here in Hong Kong, it could become increasingly difficult to see who these people are. There are some sophisticated searches and things that we can do that relate to cross-directorships and the rest. These will become less accurate as a consequence of less data being around. The more common the name, the more difficulty. If I were a solicitor, I'd be probably very happy with this, because presumably there'll be lots and lots of applications to see the original records which a law firm will make. So if I was a solicitor, I might see this as a moneymaker. I don't know, but I don't see anybody else being particularly happy. Although this is a Hong Kong law and a Hong Kong ordinance, we ought to look at it also in conjunction with what's going on the mainland, because obviously most of our business ventures registered here but have some form of mainland association. I can give them out later if anyone's interested, but on the 24th of April 2012, on the official Ministry of Public Security website, they announced a crackdown on companies aggregating information in China. 161 quote-unquote illegal databases were damaged. 611 companies who had unlawfully collected company data were shut down. So there's a major crackdown on the mainland on what, to be honest, is basically AIC, Administration of Industry and Commerce Records, in play. I'm sure that this is not a conspiracy of any sort. I believe in the theory that this is a cock-up, not a conspiracy. But the combined effect of what's going on the mainland, plus the implications of these changes, are very dangerous. So I think I'd like to commend the FCC for taking a stand on it. I think it's an appropriate thing. I'm going to talk too long. I'd like to leave the floor open for questions. But this is a very bad thing for Hong Kong at a time when we really do need more transparency, not less. Thank you very much indeed.
So I hate to disappoint, but you're going to get a little more of the same. I don't really have the other side of the argument to articulate for you. What I'll do instead is tell you why this is an incremental victory for people who are seeking to commit fraud and disguise their identity, and an incremental defeat for people like journalists, private equity funds that need to evaluate investment decisions, and lawyers. Our practice, a lot of our practice is engaged in asset tracing and judgment enforcement. So picking up a judgment that perhaps a financial institution in the West has secured against an entity in Asia for theft of intellectual property, for securities fraud, any number of fraudulent schemes that may have occurred and victimized a company or individual in the West. And what we do is trace the assets of the fraudster and then work within the court systems in various jurisdictions to seize those assets. So what I want to share with you, what I want to do is just lay out the argument for why this is an incremental victory for the people that we're after to try to enforce those judgments. First, fraud by its nature is very personal. Right? It's committed by an individual or a group of individuals, and it's based on a relationship of trust that person establishes with his victim. So sort of the outset of the argument, at the core of fraud is an individual. Second, in order for fraudsters to successfully make away with the proceeds of the fraud, they need to keep distance from themselves and wherever they hold the assets. So again, because it's personal, the identity of the fraudster is often known to the victim. So the fraudster needs to find a way to separate himself from the assets so that the assets cannot be easily identified and seized. It used to be numbered accounts that people could use in Switzerland and elsewhere that create an anonymous bank account. Now, however, fraudsters use companies. They create companies, sometimes dozens, sometimes hundreds of companies, in elaborate frauds where there's a steady flow of illegal proceeds, need layers of entities, a holding company structure, and often a structure that leads back to the Cayman Islands and BVI. To get further distance, for the fraudster to get further distance from the assets, he might use nominee directors. So not actual people that are serving as directors of the company, but people that basically rent their name to serve as a director. Might use another company as a director of the company, which creates another layer of complexity for journalists and lawyers and others to cut through. They might choose to incorporate in multiple jurisdictions. which is never easy for people trying to unravel this because jurisdictions don't sync up on their cooperation. They have different rules. They have different definitions for company records. The company registries are organized differently. It just creates time and expense in trying to unravel it. They might choose jurisdictions that don't require disclosure of the beneficial owner, that don't require disclosure of the director names. They might choose jurisdictions, and they're out there, that don't require any identification of the person who's setting up a company. So there's a recent case I'm familiar with where a incorporation company had a website and required no hard identification of who he was interacting with and set up something like 900 companies in the BVI and Cayman. It's very easy to do. It costs about $1,000 per company to set up. Finally, and this kind of brings us back to the point that I want to make today, and then I'll sit down because I'm anxious to hear the questions that you all have. Finally, you might, if you're a fraudster, choose a jurisdiction where there can be variability among names, so where there might be multiple names, where there are multiple languages that lead to multiple versions of the same name. You might choose that jurisdiction to set up some of the companies that you're using to structure fraudulent assets, and you might be a little more emboldened if you see the government take a half step back by no longer requiring that a unique identifier be attached to each of those individuals. So that's really the sum of my argument. I'll leave it there and turn it over to Enid.
Now, before we start the Q&A questions, may I just selfishly ask, do a quick, very simple poll among our three speakers. Full ID disclosure or partial ID disclosure will be sufficient? And also residential address or designated address? I know your view on residential address. So if you could each, maybe starting with Mr. McGovern, say you're for full ID or partial ID. You have to press that.
That one, right, yeah. So I'll stick with my incremental approach. I think best to have full ID, to have partial, better to have full, and residential address I think is important as well. Anything to help distinguish one person from another. And, you know, the other benefit to that is not ending up with the wrong guy. If you're a government looking to send a subpoena to somebody who did something wrong, you want to make sure you've got the right person. So there's a sort of spillover benefit to this.
Steve?
Full ID for sure, 100%. I'd add to that CCC codes, because people romanize Chinese characters differently between Singapore, Malaysia, and Hong Kong, so we get Tan and Chan and Wang and Wang. And in fact, the character is the same, so we could make sure that we make the codes the basis of what we do. That would make cross-checking and things a lot easier. And finally, as to addresses, I think it's not unreasonable to have an address through which you can be legally served documents. So in my business, I upset people quite regularly who are money launderers and people who don't like me, and I'm not too keen on them appearing at my house on Sunday morning either, so I am somewhat sympathetic with that. So I think, but it's got to be a real address, not something in Prince's Building with 7,687 other businesses. I mean, that's the problem, which is then in turn registered to the BVI and so on. That's the difficulty with not prescribing a real address. So personally, because I believe everyone's entitled through through human rights to the best prosecution available. I personally would continue with the addresses, but that's because I'm more on the prosecution side of life. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
And David, full ID or partial IDs?
Oh, full ID, definitely. In fact, the proposition from the government is only to obscure some digits of the ID. They're not proposing to take the whole thing away from public scrutiny. But full ID, the only way to have unique identifiers is to have the full ID number. If you take out three digits, then you're 1 in 1,000 people with the same other digits. Mm. And there will be cases where people have the same name and the same four digits out of the seven digits available. So definitely full identifiers. That'll make the whole thing much clearer.
Mm. Okay, thank you. Right, now it's your turn to ask questions. Any hands from the audience? No questions? I don't believe it. Ah, there's a gentleman.
Can I ask, why are the government wanting to propose this change to the law? Does anybody have any reasons?
Yeah, incompetence. I really don't think there's any great conspiracy here. I think that they have misconceived the ID number. They do treat it like a secret. There shouldn't be a problem. I mean, I was a bit surprised that the journalists didn't think about putting their ID numbers in that newspaper announcement that they published the other day, just to make the point. You know, here's the announcement, but there could be lots of Amy Wongs in Hong Kong. There are. Which one of them signed this letter? Are they afraid of disclosing their real identity? Surely not. So perhaps next time they do a petition, they'll put their ID numbers up as well.
I don't think it's just incompetence. I mean, although I have to say this is a very, very incompetent process that's led to this. And I'm shocked that people in LegCo and elsewhere didn't pick up on this, you know, much earlier. But let's put that to one side. There are reasons why, for example, people applying for credit cards with people's addresses and ID cards. There have been all sorts of abuses like that. I mean, the bank should deal with that situation.
I am pressing. Oh, sorry.
So, yeah, I think that... the technology is wonderful. But essentially, there have been some cases where people have abused data that they've got publicly for frauds, for fraudulent practices, and to obtain lines of credit and all sorts of stuff with more data than they should have had. Personally, I don't think it's a big deal, and I think it's, in terms of balance and proportionality, the gain, you know, is far outweighed by the loss of data.
I mean, you can reduce fraud by teaching people not to just rely on spoken ID numbers. You've got to see the card, or you've got to have a digital certificate from the card, even better. The card that we all carry actually has the potential for a thumbprint authentication. You could go into a bank, slide your card into a reader to prove that it's not a fake card with the number on it, and stick your thumb on it. But that application is only available right now to the immigration department at the exit point of Hong Kong. That could be made properly available in the next generation of cards, because the current ones we have are obsolete, by the way. They don't take 2048-bit ID card ID certs.
We did ask the Financial Services and Treasury Bureau and the Privacy Commissioner to join us today, but they were sadly unavailable.
Andrew. We've had in the press over the news reports over the past day or so about police using the identities of dead children in the United Kingdom in order to get an identity that they could go undercover and infiltrate groups and so on. This is a question mainly for Steve Vickers. I mean, as a former policeman, if you actually did have all of these unique ID numbers and identification and so on, wouldn't that make undercover work an awful lot more difficult for the police?
It is. In fact, even Facebook has made undercover work very much more difficult. So I'm surprised that they needed to use, I mean, without going into sordid details, governments do issue numbers and things. I'm surprised that they didn't just do what they should have done, which is issue a block for such activities to be done professionally without distressing the families, perhaps, of people who have passed away. But all governments need to run undercover operations. It's part of, I used to run for the government, and without giving any great secrets away, there would be a facility to do that. It just strikes me that somebody must have made a dumb decision in the management structure, perhaps to avoid red tape or whatever. I think the issue really was distress that it might be caused to the people who passed away, to the families of those that have passed away, rather than the fact that the government needed to do that stuff. I think all governments do.
That gentleman over there.
What is the situation in other countries? I mean, if you're somewhere like the UK where there is no ID number, is there not the same problem with people with same names? And also addresses, how many countries require directors to disclose their residential addresses?
Each country has a different approach. Some countries, of course, have no national ID number system. The UK is an example of that. They do have something called the national insurance number, but that isn't really used as the ID numbering system. So what they do to distinguish between identical names like John Smith and David Jones and so on is to require dates of birth to be on the register and publicly available. If you search the UK Companies Registry for an existing company, you'll find the dates of birth of the directors, and that makes it much less likely, not impossible, but much less likely that you're looking at two different people with the same name and date of birth.
I think a good observation. When I was thinking through this issue in my time at the SEC,
I recalled that there is no social security number required for directors. And so my first take at this issue was, well, why is everybody so upset? You know, many Western countries, many developed countries don't have a unique identifier or don't require that the unique identifier be included. And I think where I've gotten to on that point is, well, Hong Kong did. And Hong Kong has found itself high up on the transparency index and has helped draw business and develop business as a result of that. So if we are where we are, why take that half step back and send the wrong signal?
We should actually learn from the US situation. They've made a complete mess of it by, again, pretending that the SSN number should be a personal secret. And that actually facilitates identity fraud. Because if one of the many people who knows your SSN number from credit card companies, reference agencies, and so on, hospitals, you know, if they have that data, but it's supposed to be a secret, they can then impersonate you. On the other hand, if that data is publicly available, they'll have to find some other way to impersonate you. At the very least, they'll have to fake your SSN card when they show it to somebody. So the way forward is transparency. You know, sunshine is the best disinfectant of these things. It does make it harder to fake identities rather than easier.
I was wondering also whether, instead of looking backwards, we couldn't look forwards. I mean, the way one searches on these things, it's very, very sort of 1960s, 1970s, whether more intelligent searching could be facilitated. You know, it starts to suggest to you as you're working through the program. I mean, we have the raw data, that there's a lot of other systems that could be placed in between to make it a more efficient system. This whole situation we've introduced now is just taking us back years and years and years and years. It's offering opportunities for organized crime to prosper. In fact, this is an opportunity to actually do something proactive to make things better, to protect people and to make things more transparent. We've lost the opportunity because we've looked backwards instead of forwards.
David Arons, associate member.
Sorry, we have two mics on.
Ladies first.
Margaret, would you like to go first? Sorry.
Yes, thank you. Like Mr. Vickers, I'd like to believe it's a cock-up and not a conspiracy. So Legko slipped up, the journalist slipped up, we all slipped up when it was before Legko. Privacy and transparency is very much a balancing matter, and we hadn't heard enough at the time of the downside of such a thing. Now that we realize it, it's perfectly straightforward to rectify it. My question is, why is the government making it so difficult? Why have they not come here and said, thank you very much for your views, we will now correct it? Technically, it is not a problem. I think there are enough lawyers here who have looked at the ordinance to tell you that it is not a problem. It has not come into effect and it can easily be rectified. So if the government proves to be very hard to persuade, then Mr. Vickers, I'm afraid we have to revise our views, and it may well be a conspiracy, not a cock-up.
Sorry. Gentlemen.
If Mr. Vickers has my ID number, what information can he find out about me?
Well, obviously it's a very worrying position for you, isn't it? No. there's a lot of stuff. Businesses, companies, directorships, cross-directorships, bankruptcy. There's lots of stuff that's already out there. It's just more efficiently searched. Well, I mean, for example, without the identity card number, if people want to find out whether their spouse, who they're marrying, has been married before or not, is now more difficult. All sorts of things, all sorts of unintended consequences as this kick in. But there's a huge amount of data. Personally, I hate giving my ID card when I go to Bank of China building for a meeting. They always ask you for your ID card, and somebody writes, I thought, well, who keeps that? What right have you got to keep that? How long do you keep it for? And are you using it, because I'm a suspicious sort of guy, are you using it to apply for credit cards later? I mean, there's a vast amount of data. The Hong Kong government has seized upon it. The point is, I don't think we can go backwards. We can go forwards. To Margaret's point about cock-up versus conspiracy, I'm open-minded. I do have this public security document, which is issued on their official website. It's not me. It's the Public Security Bureau of China's website, announcing a crackdown on AIC records, which is worth a look at. But I just think governments are not that organized, and I doubt they'd be able to coordinate it or pull it off that way. But clearly this is something that I think is correctable, and we should just correct it. And maybe the answer is the government's attitude now is mjom chaw, is just don't do anything, you'll get into trouble. So nobody wants to pick up the cudgel. You know, I think it's maybe that's it.
I mean, generally the government isn't very good at admitting its mistakes. There's a lot of face involved in climbing down from something like this, but they need to climb down. There's enough opposition to it. You know, in terms of what the ID number by itself can reveal about someone, very, very little. I'm about to publish one of my next but one stories will be an index of publicly available ID numbers with names on the internet. This is not new in the sense that if you search for those names with ID, you would find their number. But I've got about 1,000 of them, including several billionaires and well-known figures. And I'll just put that up to demonstrate how widely available this stuff is.
So you got the ID numbers not from company searches, you said?
I did not take anything from behind the paywall. It's all, you hit the link, there'll be a source next to each ID number, and you can see where I got it. It's already publicly available. I mean, another issue for mistaken identity is no-fly lists. Famously, Cat Stevens was kicked off a plane to America because his name matched Yusuf Ismail. His Islamic name matched someone who was on the no-fly list, and that's happened several times. So, you know, there's a benefit to the public interest of being uniquely identified and not being confused with someone less desirable in many cases.
But I do think part of the complexity is how successful the Smart ID program has been in Hong Kong, and that they capture so much information about our comings and our goings and our sicknesses and our families. And really all we need to do is take a very narrow sliver of what is available through the Smart Card platform, and that is just confirming you are who you are. We don't need to know anything else. And I think David's point is, and I'm not the one to speak on this, but if you only have the number, I don't think you have a way to back into that full treasure trove of data.
I mean, if you have illegal access to someone's database, you're going to find out a lot about them whether or not you have the ID number. You just won't be certain that it is them if you only have their name. But you'll still be able to find out all the records about Steve Vickers. You just don't know if it's that Steve Vickers that you're looking at. If you don't have illegal access to those private databases, then all you've got is the number. If your number starts with a W, you're a foreign domestic helper, I can tell you that much, because they all start with W for work or something. But apart from that, and there seems to be, for people like myself who weren't born in Hong Kong, a lot of us seem to have a P or an R if they're from the mainland. I'm not quite sure what that code actually means, but that's about all you can deduce from the number on its own.
But we're not talking about like ordinary citizens, everyone, all 7 million of us having to declare our ID cards. We're talking about, you know, directors of limited companies. Don't you think that the issue seems to be that these people have more of a duty, perhaps a fiduciary duty, to declare more than just, you know?
I agree 100%, because there are benefits to having a limited company. I mean, you can only go bust for so much, but yet the people who have been supplying you, you know, having to take a risk. So there are responsibilities that come with being a director of a company or owning a limited company. So I do think, yes, you know, it's different than a private individual. And it does protect you to a certain extent. So I think that's been kind of overlooked by this whole process, the nature of companies per se. You know.
We have time for two more questions. It's a gentleman in the veranda.
Hello there. I'm Kian Ng from House Williams Bowers. I just want to find out from any one of the panelists if they know what is the view from the Privacy Commissioner on this. I'm actually very surprised that this actually initiative appears to have come from the corporate or the economics side of the government, and instead of being sponsored by the Privacy Commissioner, which one would think would be the logical place, it's actually come from somewhere else. And I'm interested to know whether the Privacy Commissioner has a view or position on this. Thank you.
Does anyone have any views on this?
I think it's evident from the fact that they're unwilling to field people to defend their own law that they don't currently have a view. They may have had a view when they proposed it, but we don't see anyone from that office. I can't believe they're all on holiday, even if the commissioner himself or herself is. Surely they could have sent someone to discuss the point. They haven't. At least that indicates perhaps that they are halfway through a climb down and they're open to submissions against the current proposals.
Well,
Margaret is shaking her head and says no.
Well, yes, but he also, it was also reported that he said,
interesting.
Well, there is, yeah.
The other voice,
the commissioner hasn't said a lot in public, but he did say that the current, the status quo doesn't actually break any laws, any privacy laws in Hong Kong as it stands. And also, I think the FSTB, the Financial Service Treasury Bureau, told us that they are still in conversation with the Privacy Commissioner over this.
Yes, it's clear that we haven't been breaking the law all these years by having that information out there. So I don't think the Privacy Commissioner has, other than some moral issue that he might have, doesn't have any legal grounds to stand in the way.
The other voice that might be interesting to hear from is the SFC, where they've recently put forward sponsor liability, so they put more weight on the diligence process that sponsors need to do in bringing new issues to the market, and at the same time taking at least one tool away from them in accomplishing that.
Yes, the duck is not talking to the chicken as it related in this situation. There's more and more compliance requirements, but they're cutting back, making it more and more difficult on access to data. I'm not crying about it because I probably make more money in the end because I do the due diligence, but it certainly makes it much more difficult for ordinary firms on a daily basis, and it really is utterly counterproductive and a waste of time.
Okay, last.
I think one way forward might be, if there's any doubt about the privacy law, and we might have been breaking the law all these years, let's amend the privacy ordinance and make clear that not only is your name not a piece of private information, but nor is the identifier attached to it. Okay, everything else is private, but not the identifier. So if we put that into the law, there can be no issue on the subject.
Okay, last question. Tom.
Yes, hi. Enid, everyone here is against the idea of non-disclosure. During the consultation, about two-thirds of the submissions were in favor of non-disclosure from the Institute of Directors, Institute of Chartered Secretaries, several of the Chambers of Commerce, and a whole bunch of acronyms. I don't know who they
are. These are the same people that oppose quarterly financial reporting, by the way.
Yeah,
non-disclosure is their theme.
Indeed. Did we ask any of them to come along? Have we had any response?
I'm afraid we didn't. That's a good point, actually. We are still trying to get, for example, the Privacy Commissioner to come next month when he returns from his holiday, so watch this space. And thanks for the suggestion. Maybe we should broaden the net, invite the others to the same event.
I mean, just because the obvious thing that springs out is a lot of people didn't even know that this measure was included in the company law reform. And the overwhelming response to the consultation was in favor of non-disclosure.
Two-thirds by number, but some of them were probably duplicates. I mean, I think the important thing in all consultations is not to try and treat it like a numerical opinion poll, but to look at whether arguments have been made that mean your proposition is wrong and that you should rethink it. That's an open-minded approach to a consultation rather than one that either bulldozes ahead because you've had a numerical weight in favor. Or ignores the majority because you decide that their arguments are wrong, when even the majority is saying, making good arguments.
Okay, I'm afraid this is all we have time for. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for attending, and thank you to our three guests. We have souvenirs on the ground for each one of you. Oh.